Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome. We are joined in studio by Anne McCarthy, who's an associate dean at the Johns Hopkins Carey Business School. She was a Republican candidate for comptroller about 4 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Brian Griffiths, who's a writer for Red Maryland, which is an online conservative journal. And Trey Lewis, who is president of the Baltimore City Young Republicans. And good to have you all with us.
Thank you, Mark.
Great to be back.
410-319-8888, 410-319-8888 to join us here on the Mark Steiner Show. And to bring you across the airways, we'll talk about what's happening in the state, what's happening in the country from their perspective, where they think America is going, and some internal questions to their Republican world. Brian Griffiths often jokes when he comes to the show, he says, his friends say, why do you want to go on that show? I don't know what they mean by that, but he said, why do you want to go on that show? And he says, because he likes to kind of be challenged, and I don't know what he means by that either. But we thought we would kind of expand it tonight and throw myself in the middle of this and see where we go.
We have you surrounded.
I know. Usually we're the lonely onlys.
The first time in my life. I'm going to fight my way out of circles a lot. But in all seriousness, I'd like to start with this. And we posed a question pre-November when you all were on the show, but the two of you, I'm pointing to my right, you can't see that, can you? I'm sorry. Brian Griffiths and Anne McCarthy had a difference of opinion on this show about the results of the election and what it said about the Tea Party and about the centrist or the mainstream establishment Republican Party and what happened. So I'd like to get your analysis now. When you see this new Congress about to happen, and Trey, join into this as well.
Right,
I'm just
no
turning over here first because they raised the issue with one another first. So, Anne.
Well, I think Brian and I sort of split the bet, which was that the Senate remained Democratic, which I said it would, and the House went Republican, which Brian had predicted both houses would go. And I still sort of stick to my original thoughts on that, which was I think we would have won more houses in the Senate had it, or more seats in the Senate had not been for the Tea Party. We could have won both Utah and Delaware, except for those unusual Tea Party candidates, to be kind to them. Because to me, too many members of the Tea Party are at the fringe of the Republican, and they what I consider to be sort of the core Republican. And they push out moderate Republicans like me. And I don't think that's good for the health of the party going forward. Although I have to say it's great for the health of the party going forward that I'm the oldest Republican in this room. And I look at Brian and Trey as like the next generation. I'm very happy.
Well, as far as Delaware goes, I don't think that was necessarily the issue of the candidate's ideas as it was the candidate herself. Christine O'Donnell was not the best candidate to put forth as with her personal baggage that went along with it. If you look at Alaska, that was just a horribly run campaign and just a complete train wreck. And that's just a seat that was held by a quote Republican unquote Lisa Murkowski. I still think, you know, if you look at the House, what you had a situation where you had a lot of Tea Party candidates who successfully not only knocked off Republican incumbents, but also knocked off Democrat incumbents. There were a lot of House seats that we won with more conservative candidates. People who there were a couple seats down in Texas, for example, that turned from Democrat to Republican that weren't even on anybody's radar because of what we had nominated conservative candidates and candidates who focused on the fiscal issues. They were not necessarily social conservatives, but they were very, very good on the fiscal issues. And I think that's what we saw. What that means going forward is going to be what's very interesting, because now you have a little bit of a power struggle in Washington between the Tea Party folks who are committed to their ideas and the Washington establishment. We were just talking about this off air about how there's going to be two Republican responses to the State of the Union tonight.
Yeah.
The official response.
One official response
and then Michelle Bachmann, Tea Party.
And the official response is from Congressman Paul Ryan, the Budget Committee Chairman of the House, who is by no means an establishment moderate, particularly on fiscal issues. He's one of our experts, very good young gun on fiscal issues. But then Michelle Bachmann is going to represent the Tea Party wing, so much as that the Tea Party wing can be represented by any one person or faction. But it's just very interesting. That's going to be the interesting dynamic that's going to see where we see what happens not only in this Congress, but what happens in the 2012 election, particularly as we go forth with no clear establishment frontrunner for the presidential nomination on the Republican side, as to how the Tea Party and the establishment gets along and whether or not the coalition holds or the coalition explodes.
Yeah.
And that's the biggest problem I
see. Lewis.
That's the biggest problem I see going forward, just to extend off of what Brian is saying, is that the Tea Party are idealists. They're checkers. They had grassroots. A lot of it's organic grown dissatisfaction with government, and they put their candidates forward because they wanted their candidates from day one to go in and check what has been unchecked for the past 2 years and actually before that, as far as fiscal mismanagement, things of that sort with government. What the established Republicans are trying to do is let them know how to actually do that. And I think the Tea Partiers want to go in day one and set the room on fire, when the established Republicans are saying, well, you know, we want to do the same thing as well, but there's an actual way and step forward to do it to make it successful. And I think that's the biggest problem, is that the two sides are going to say the Tea Party wants to do things one day. They want to do it fast. They want immediate results. And they don't want no for an answer, as opposed to the Republicans that are established Republicans. They're going to say, well, we want results, too. We're not going to take no for an answer. But there's a protocol. There's a Washington way of doing it. And the Tea Party doesn't want to hear the Washington way of doing it. They want the Tea Party way of doing it. And I think those two sides eventually are going to have to, at some point, merge together and make things happen.
And that's one of the key things. Marco Rubio, the new senator from Florida, was asked to join the Tea Party Caucus, the Michelle Bachmann organization that's being put together, and he actually said no. And it's part of the dynamic and the struggle that's going to happen between Washington and the activists that are outside of Washington, because if you see an organization like the so-called Tea Party Caucus entrenched in Washington with members of Congress involved in it, you could see the disillusion of possibly the Tea Party activists, people who see that the Tea Party has, quote, gone Washington. And that's another part of the struggle, where you have to be concerned that the Tea Party activists really aren't concerned with creating the establishment in Washington. The people that they sent there to be their representatives for the issues that they believe in, not to become part of the cliquish nature of D.C. Trey, you're absolutely correct insofar as that the Tea Party activists do need to be educated, some of them, on the way to get business done, mm-hmm. that there is a certain way to get this done, that you can stick to your ideals and stick to the principles that got you to Washington but you have to play the game in order to get things done.
I cannot help but remember the Sesame Street little episode that, you know, with cute little music, that's how a bill becomes a law. Maybe we should send that to the Tea Party.
Right. And that's important because, you know, it's sort of like looking at a bunch of USC students doing a script and a film class. And they're like trying to make that a brilliant script, a great movie idea, into a movie. Because there's a way on taking ideas and thoughts and processes and making it actual whole. And I don't believe the Tea Party at sometimes wants to hear that. And I understand the dire straits that we are in fiscally, and I understand the economy needs a kick and a boost. But they have to understand that the only way to successfully do this, and so we won't have to revisit these same issues a year or two down the road, is that we actually have sustained success. And I'm hoping that the established Republican leadership will reach out to the Tea Party and include them, and I'm hoping the Tea Party wants to include them. They can also listen and talk, because, you know, as the old saying goes, you have two ears and one mouth.
I think the interesting thing in 2012, and I'll let you get a question in here, Mark,
that they've taken over not just Congress, but not
elephants
my show.
Elephants in the room.
What is this about?
Is that in the past two election cycles, people were angry, and so they threw the party in power out. They threw the Republicans out and put the Democrats in charge. Right. And then this time they split the houses. But they basically threw a lot of Democrats out and put the Republicans back in charge. I don't think people are going to be angry in 2012. So I don't see Barack Obama.
What do you mean they're not going to be angry in 2012?
Well, the Dow almost hit 12,000 today. The Fed's monetary policy is working. I mean, unemployment is still high, but it is a lagging indicator. And so all of the preceding indicators that are on a positive trend. Unemployment should start going down in the next couple of years. I think we're beginning to see the revival of the economy, and by 2011, we're not going to be so angry about everything. Now, there'll still be people, pockets of unemployment. We'll still be dealing with foreclosures, but not the way we have been mm-hmm. for the past 4 years.
Yeah. Now,
I mean, the Dow is almost 12,000. People should be like,
but to
that's
be fair,
incredible.
That, but to be fair, for a lot of middle and working class Americans, you know, they what the Dow's success does not necessarily equate to their success.
That's they're all looking at 401ks that have recovered.
But a lot of folks may not have jobs or have a 401k at the moment.
And it's the Dow of recovery we're talking about here, TAO. I mean, I'm not that optimistic. I think this recovery is not going to be much of a recovery. I think recovery right now is a recovery at the top. And I think that's what got people angry that put Barack Obama in office. And I think that's what people got angry about that made people stay home and or put people who are in the Tea Party into office. And I just don't see it. I don't see it. Right now we're seeing that economic boom, but it's not for the regular Americans. People still don't know that their number one fear is retirement. People know how they're going to retire in America. Don't know what they're going to do. First time in American history, we have a nation where we think that our children will not do as well as we did. That's what we face. And the question I let me throw this out to you. Then we'll go to Michael and LaVon. You're the first two callers up. We're going to come to your calls. Who's out there? I mean, I don't think that the centrist Democratic control of Congress before gave us many answers. They gave us the health care bill, et
cetera. That's not centrist.
Oh, the health care bill is Republican.
Oh, yeah. From the 90s, yeah.
The health care bill was the bill that they introduced under Clinton to oppose the Democrats, and it's the bill that mimics the Romney bill in Massachusetts. It's a Republican bill. It's not even a Democratic bill. It's a bill. In this administration, in many ways, to me, has been one of these, at least in terms of sheer American politics, has been one of these bend over, and we'll pretend we're Democrats' bills. And it was actually a Republican bill, not a Democrat bill that won. And now the right wing Republicans want to get rid of that bill. But so I'm not so sure. I have not seen what I was trying to say I'm not saying succinctly. I did not see very many clear answers by a lot of Democrats when they had control. They lost control. I don't see any clear answers coming from the Republican society. They say, cut, 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 cut. But he had no answers to how you're going to deal with any of the issues that we face in this country. So I think Americans are going to get – I think they make it very frustrating in 2012.
Mm.
We'll see. I mean, we'll have this bet now. We'll come together in 2012 and see who buys dinner.
Okay.
Mark, you're absolutely right. I think there's going to be two things that has to happen with this new Congress. There's going to have to be what the American people feel and what actually is happening on paper. What the American people feel, as you say, is far from the Dow being up on points. It's far from, you know, the top tier doing well and the stock market starting to, get the train moving again and things of that sort. Because people still have huge uncertainties. People aren't going to retire. And people don't feel as though that there is a proper work out there for them, even with the proper credentials. People feel as though that the prices are soaring too high and it's not coupled with their income going up. And so that's what the American people feel. But on paper, though, I think it's important that sign of that the government is doing its part, its real part. You know, them saying that they want to slash the budget down to 08 levels. OK, that's important. But like you said, how is that going to happen? Are they going to do across-the-board cuts? Are they going to do away with certain programs that really do affect people? And I think that's important is that what has to happen is the merger of the two, what people actually feel and actually see and then what the government is actually doing. And like you said, I don't believe that the Democratic-controlled Congress really did anything to show the American people that they had their best interests at heart. And also that was sustained with the feeling that, you know, all is lost. I mean, people lost thousands in their 401ks. People were losing their jobs with proper credentials. The foreclosures and things of that sort was just crazy. And so that's what's going to have to happen over a couple of years. And I still think that President Obama has a good chance of winning reelection. But I believe that we, the Republican Party, will do better, even more so in 2012 if things aren't turned around.
Mm-hmm.
And now actually it's a very interesting point about the president's chances for reelection, because if you go back to 1994 and the throttling that the Democrats got after Clinton's first 2 years in office, that swept in two Republican houses, which gave Clinton a very good foil for the next 2 years of his administration. And the combination of Clinton having a Republican Congress as a foil and running a presidential election campaign against one of the old guard Republicans who was a part of the leadership of his foil made it very easy for him to blame all of Washington's problems on the Republicans. Mm-hmm. Whether or not they were it was his fault, their fault, didn't matter.
Plus, he co-opted Republican stances like welfare reform.
Exactly. Yeah.
That was a Republican bill, not a Clinton.
Exactly.
Democratic
and Barack Obama does not have that luxury right now because for two reasons. One, the Democrats still control the Senate, so part of Congress is still with him ideologically. And number two, as we talked about, the establishment wing of the party, at least at the presidential politics level, is not in a position to have a favorite candidate go forward like Bob Dole was in 1996. And that's going to impact both the ability of the president to get his agenda moving, which I think is going to be very difficult for him with the Republicans in Congress. And two, it's going to be very hard for him to play the Republicans off as a foil, considering the lack of an established Republican who's part of the quote problem unquote in Washington, and the fact that he still has Harry Reid to push through his legislative agenda in the Senate.
That's good.
Sure. Should we open the phones here?
Open the phones.
I'm going to open the phones. I'll throw something out for all of our listeners to consider as well, and the three my three guests from the Republican Party, Ann McCarthy, who is the dean of the Hopkins Business School and former candidate for comptroller. Which is where we first met, Brian mm-hmm. Griffiths, who is a writer for Red Maryland, we don't call it conservative. What would you call it? Libertarian? Would you call it conservative? What would you call it, Red Maryland?
The premier blog of conservative and Republican political ideas and thoughts in the state of Maryland.
That's what he would call it. The premier blog of Republican thought in the state of Maryland. How's that? Do you like that?
Close enough.
That's good. That works. And Trey Lewis is president of the Baltimore City Young Republicans.
Yep.
410-319-8888. And I would say that again, I'll throw it out here, and I like you didn't really comment on what I said before, so I'll say it in more edgy terms. I think that the health care bill, which to me was better than nothing, but was a corporate bill, and what Americans got tired of was watching corporate power play its power in the halls of Congress and create a bill to their liking, and Americans got tired of that debate. They just got sick of listening to it, I think. Mm-hmm. Most Americans couldn't even give you a minute understanding of what the bill entails.
Yeah, you're absolutely right.
It was just a bill that got too complex and they got tired of the machinations.
And it didn't help that the members of Congress didn't read it before they voted for it.
Well, some didn't.
And that was okay by Nancy Pelosi. It's true.
And the other is the question of Citizens United and that whole debate over corporate speech in America. I think that's a big factor going to play out in different ways over the next couple of years, how we can talk about. And maybe both parties will, in the next 10 years, will implode. That's a possibility.
Maybe.
410-319-8888. What's it all mean, Alfie? Michael, you're on the air.
So first let me say, that's a ruse. None of these members read all of the bills. They use their staff. And so let's not act like we don't know how Congress works. But let me ask three Socratic questions. Why is it that the Republicans cannot seem to acknowledge any system or system effects except the free market system? I mean, we act like we don't understand how things work. We have hard science and social science, and yet the only thing that the Republicans ever put forth as a panacea to everything is the free market system. And so you see this backlash against government, but what we should, our point of departure should be that we agree that the sole role of government is to solve externalities, negative externalities, and to encourage positive ones. But because all you guys talk about is the market, you never get to an analysis that's meaningful. And then secondly, when is the Republican Party going to have minorities that are authentically part of their community, not sort of tokens or represented in communities that don't have their traditional heritage at heart? When are you going to get folks that are legitimately part of solutions and respected by their community and as part of your leadership versus, folks like Michael Steele who are disposable Me Too answers? And I will let you respond. I will posit, however, that I think it's because the Republican Party has become a party of bumper stickers and is completely bereft of ideas. We on the progressive end, who understand systems and understand people and communities, want to have intelligent conversations, but it's impossible with a party that that refuses to do so.
Michael, is this the Michael I think it is? Michael?
Mark. Yeah.
You still there?
Yes.
Is this the Michael I think it is?
Yeah, and you owe me a mango chicken sandwich.
Friday noon, same place.
All right, okay.
All right, man.
Okay, good stuff.
I do owe him a chicken salad sandwich.
Mango.
How did you know it was mango?
Because he just said mango.
It. Oh, I didn't hear that part.
That's pretty funny.
So let's talk about that. I think that he raised some real issues. I think that all three issues he raised, the role of somebody like Michael Steele, who for some played the buffoon role for some people in the party, and I don't think it was really respected, whether he deserved it or not, and the role that he played in as a front man in many ways, and B, what Michael said about free market systems, that everything is going to be done by the marketplace, that's going to define everything in America. And I think there is some credence to what he said last, which was Republicans have become, and really good at it, because they've been able to play the game very well, the bumper sticker party. Throw out a phrase, and we'll make it stick.
Well, the Democrats have been doing just as good a job of that, too.
I think they're terrible at bumper stickers. That's their problem. Well, there's not many bumper stickers going on.
But the problem is, and it's funny because the three of us were talking about this before
we
came on air, is the fact that, a lot of the times when you try to, at least in the experiences that I've had, when you try to engage, quote, progressives, which is a code word for far left.
Why do you say things like this? That kind of stuff you said is such a bunch of crap. But anyway, go ahead. I mean, but this whole notion of far left, far right, I think most America is sick of far left, far right.
Okay, I'll rephrase. Progressive, which is a synonym for far outside the mainstream, is.
And Tea Party's inside the mainstream.
Going there. But the point is, a lot of times when we try to engage progressives, liberals, whatever you want to call them, in intelligent conversation, it's a lot of the feedback that I get is, you guys are evil. You guys are this. You guys are that. I mean, I think it's not fair to say that one side is trying to engage in thought and the other's not.
Well, let me stop. There's a question about that, and we'll come to the other questions he raised. And LaVon, you're going to come next. And one of the things, and Trey, what Brad just said, it's real about America. What you just said about what you think people who are liberal or left, whatever you want to call people, cannot talk to people on the right. Well, mm-hmm. I think people who are on the liberal end of the spectrum of America say the same thing.
Yes.
I can't talk to people on the right because they don't want to listen to what I have to say.
Yes, our public conversation has degenerated to the extent that we have people on either extreme yelling at each other across a great divide.
I think what's a very important thing to understand is that our party—
And all the moderates are left out.
Our party is a party that's fixated on certain traditions and certain things that have been consistent with American history. One of those things is the free markets. I mean, we're unwavering on that position. We are unwavering on the position.
So explain what you mean by that. I mean, there are very few people in this country. There are some, clearly, who think the marketplace is at the root of the problem. But there are very few people in America who don't believe in a marketplace. It depends how you define it.
And what I mean by the marketplace, I'm not just talking about Wall Street. I'm not just talking about Goldman Sachs stockbrokers. I'm talking about the small businesses. I'm talking about you as American having the ability to participate in capitalism. I'm talking about you as a consumer or as a seller to be able to go out there and use your profits for gain. And that's what we're talking about, the free market. We're talking about the ability to go outside without any inhibitions to say to yourself, I'm going to invest my money this way or that way, without very few restrictions, without very few playbooks given by the government to tell you how you should do it. And that's why we believe that's the best way to go, because quite honestly, it's been the most successful method. It's for individuals to have the power, the utmost empowerment to go out there and foster economic growth on their own.
The essential philosophical question is really, which divides Republicans and Democrats, what Trey is talking about, which is, do we believe that some really brilliant people in the government can sit down and solve a problem for millions of people, or do we believe that individuals working at that millions level can basically create a direction that solves the problem on its own. And there are some cases, like national defense, where millions of people working on their own do not solve the problem.
And where can't
And where we need, can't, where we need government. Exactly. And there are some cases, like the basic sort of marketplace of buyers and sellers, mm-hmm. where less government interference, except for creating an equal playing field and honesty and
like what? Give me an example of what you're talking about.
The latter?
Mm-hmm.
Well, exactly what Trey was saying. If I want to put a shingle out in front of my house and I want to say that I'm open for business to resell mm-hmm. little antiques that I go and find by spending my time and effort going from flea market to estate sale, and I bring them all in one place and then I can resell them, I should have the right to do that. It shouldn't be the matter of getting back in England. And we all have to remember that this is sort of a historic reaction to what was happening in Great Britain, where I'd have to get a stamp and it'd be Her Majesty or His Majesty. Stamp approval, and I mean, there was just such a restraint of trade that the colonies separated from that we forget in our history. I think it's, by the way, I think it's great that they read the Constitution on the second day.
That was awesome.
That was awesome.
Yeah, it was.
I think it's lovely too. I don't know how. I didn't move me as much as moved some other people. But I thought it was good they did it. I'm glad they did it.
We forget from where we've come.
But a lot of people calling, I want to get them on the air, but let me just kind of respond this way. I mean, I think that playing off what you said earlier, Brian, I mean to call you Brad a minute ago, I'm sorry, Brian.
Yeah, I've been called worse.
No, but I shouldn't have. I won't do that. But, and that's my brother's name too, Brian. So is that there's a mean-spiritedness to, I think, things I read like in your place online and things I read further to the left sometimes online, that kind of poison discussions we have before we get them started. I think there are honest disagreements about how things work. In other words, I mean, the marketplace is an important part of our society, but what you're saying, what you two are understanding what I'm saying, but let me just posit this as maybe is not opposed to that, but a different perspective on that. What we're talking about here is not saying that someone shouldn't be able to put a shingle out on their house to say, I'll fix your car. Like I left my mechanic this morning, right? Guy's brilliant. I never go to a big fix-it place. I go to my buddy Ray, who fixes hundreds of cars. We don't know how many cars a week he fixes. But he's brilliant. He thinks about the cars. I can trust him. We have a handshake. He knows what he does. He does the work. Mm-hmm. He does it in this huge yard behind his house. Has all the equipment and does it. I'd prefer to deal with a journeyman like that every day of the week. That's the way I like to live my life.
That's the free market, though.
So, and I would walk to him, and if I killed him and said, I'm really short this week, and I owe him $1,000. I said, I'll give you $300. He said, take the car, give me the rest later, which we do. You shake your hand, and you do the deal.
Right.
You know, I come from a family where you spit in your hand, you shake your hand, deal is done, you never break it. That's right. How you live your life.
Mm-hmm.
All right? Right. But that's not what I'm talking about. When we talk about, I think what America is talking about, the marketplace here, we're talking about a marketplace that's controlled by huge power and wealth, a marketplace controlled by corporations. And that's why we need the FDA. That's why you need regulations, not to make a regulation between me and my guy I buy my chickens from, which I do as well, go to a farm and buy my chickens or lamb or milk or whatever I want from the farmer that I know. It's because you cannot trust corporations not to rip us off, poison us, and run our country. That's the problem. And so that's where, to me, the divide comes. I mean, and government does have a role.
Oh, I totally agree.
No, absolutely.
And one last thing I'll say, and I'll let you come right in here, Brian, is that I defy you, anybody at this table, that was a nasty way to put it. I'm trying not to be that way. name me a period in American history where we've had huge growth that hasn't had major infusion from the federal government.
Colonial period.
But that, we're talking about a period when there was hardly government at all.
Right.
But the economy wasn't the same. We built the American economy in the 19th century because we invested in American government money in steel, government money in railroads,
mm-hmm.
and built them. We destroyed the Native American people of the country in the process, but that's what we built them.
Mm-hmm.
That was government infusion. World War II was government infusion. The post-World War II was government infusion. When President Dwight D. Eisenhower was president, what was the tax break, tax rate for the highest bracket in America? Does anybody know?
I believe it was 90%, wasn't it?
94%.
That's because there were tax loopholes.
No, it's because the wealthy were forced to take their wealth in stock options and prove the companies could work rather than making billions of dollars on us and giving us nothing back. So that's where my vision of America differs from Republicans. I think differs from some of the Democrats as well.
But to make my point,
Mr. Griffiths,
to go back to the market, to the marketplace issue, you said that, you know, the marketplace is controlled by huge corporations. But you go to Ray for your mechanical services. You buy chickens. You are operating in a marketplace, and you choose to say, "I'm not going to buy chickens from these people. I'm going to buy chickens from this farmer." And that's great. And I'm glad that you have that option. I don't have as much time. I don't have time.
But, I have no time.
But you make time. But you make that choice in the market. You take the economic, you know, you value your time, your money. You make decisions based on what is in your best interest and how you want to allocate your resources. And you do that within the marketplace. There are some industries, for example, getting back before Obamacare, there are some industries, like, for example, healthcare, which were overly regulated by the marketplace, and the marketplace didn't work. For example, one of the ways that we could have lowered the cost of healthcare for all Americans would have been to allow you to buy coverage across state lines, and I still believe is not, even after Obamacare, is still not allowed. You still have to buy it by within your state. If you open just that removal of one government regulation would have opened up the marketplace. Would it have been solved the entire problem of healthcare? No, but it would have gone a long way towards reducing costs and improving the coverage.
That may be true, and I think that
that's right. If I can get better Blue Cross Blue Shield coverage from Blue Cross Blue Shield of Indiana than Maryland, I'm going to go spend it with Blue Cross Blue Shield of Indiana.
And I don't disagree with that on one level. As an argument about what they would pass in Congress, I don't disagree with that. But that doesn't resolve health care costs, and that doesn't resolve the health care issue as far as I'm concerned. And I'll say it, I'll put it on the table here. I mean, I think that we should be like the rest of the Western developed world, Japan, Germany, Italy, France, Great Britain, Canada, and have some form of system that guarantees health care to everyone in their country and controls the cost at the same time.
But have you seen the health care that you get in some of these countries? Completely, you know, it's abhorrent
that
care, even in Great Britain.
Myth. That is
it
such
is not a myth. There,
is,
you look, can.
Okay, well,
it's
part of the problem, is though, myth. Is many of these countries also have a private system also, and the people who can afford it opt out of the public system to go into the
private
system.
But also, you know, I can open my computer here and just we can go battle argument because I think that is one of the great mythologies that we've foisted. I mean, that is every poll in Canada says they wouldn't trade their system for ours any day of the week.
Well, I can give you a poll that says anything you want. That doesn't mean that the healthcare is anything below third world coverage in some of these hospitals.
If you're talking about government intervention, it's also important to classify what is healthcare. That's also important to know. When we talk about basic education in this country, we think K-12. When we talk about healthcare in this country, what is healthcare? That's important. If you want to talk about government intervention of healthcare, we have to classify specifically what is healthcare.
We have to take a break, and I'm going to turn this over to our listeners. All right? And we go in this order, folks. So stay with us. We're all going to get on the air. I'm not going to dominate this thing. If we're going to go to LaVon, you're next. Goes LaVon, Jamar, Clarence, Gordon, and Jim, and whoever's calling next. 410-319-8888 is the number here. We'll come to your calls in just a minute. Support for WEAA is provided by Mid-Atlantic Neurosurgical Associates, MANA, a center dedicated to those who suffer from brain, spine, and pain disorders. With three Baltimore locations, MANA's team of pain and management physicians and surgeons provide a wide range of treatment options to improve the health and well-being of its patients. More information online, MANA Pain Center, MANA Pain Center.com. Or 410-601-8314. Stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland State Mortgage Late Don't Wait program. For more information and personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-7555. We are here in studio with Ann McCarthy, Associate Dean of the Johns Hopkins Carey Business School. former Republican candidate for comptroller in the state of Maryland 4 years ago. Brian Griffiths, writer for Red Maryland, which is the premier conservative Republican journal in the state. Trey Lewis, president of the Baltimore City Young Republicans. 410-319-8888. LaVon, you're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call.
Thank you for calling. Sorry to make you wait so long.
That's okay. I agree with everything that you said, Mark. Talk to your guest. One of the things that I find real troubling as we have a national discussion about the debt is that since 1945, the national debt has been not have been added to. It's actually been on a decline as far as the contribution to the national debt by president. It wasn't until Ronald Reagan where the national debt went up an additional something like 15%, and then with every Republican, it skyrocketed. When the Democrats were in between some of the Republicans, it was minus. Like when Carter was in office, he was able to minus the national debt by 3%. And then when Clinton came in, he minus it by 9%. When this last Bush finished, the deficit, the national debt went up by 27%. Ronald Reagan, 15%. And with the father Bush, it was something like 15 or 20%. So I'm not understanding why Americans are not seeing the trend and allowing the Republicans continue to kind of tout, especially when I'm lifting up Reagan a lot, for what he has done. I'm not understanding. The truth is, if we just dealt with the truth is the national debt has always increased with the Republican Party. And it has always minus with the Democratic Party.
All right. I think you raised – Ann, looks like you're ready to say something.
Well,
please go ahead.
Trey does too. I will say, LaVon, that I believe the Tea Party movement isn't on the Republican side is in direct response to the George W. Bush's 4-8 years of unlimited spending and adding to the debt, and that the Republicans are trying to recapture their fiscal conservatism through that party. But I'm going to let Trey take it from here.
Since the Second World War ended, when I believe almost as 103% of our debt was part of our GDP, the lowest it ever was in was when the last year of the Nixon administration in 1974. The Carter administration started to uptick it a little bit. The Reagan administration uptick it again. It wasn't until 1991, I believe, that the first Bush actually made a serious effort with new taxes to try to once again fight the deficit. In the Clinton years, the deficit did grow again. And with the surplus that Clinton always talks about that he created was actually more of projection, not actual what was in the reserves. And then the Bush administration did do its share as far as the deficit is concerned. And, of course, the Obama administration did its nice number as well. So I think that's a misconception that you were talking about factually as far as the Republican administration's adding to the deficit. It's a two-way street. That's the whole purpose of the Tea Party movement, is that the Tea Party movement was not only upset with the Democratic establishment but also the Republican establishment. They were very much angered with Republican candidates going with the status quo and going as business as usual as far as deficit and as far as fiscal mismanagement. So I think it's very important to say, as far as fiscal management is concerned, that both parties and both parties' presidents have had their share and, you know, doing damage.
Now, we can come back to this another day, but I was studying some graphs this morning that showed that the debt was lowest in America when taxes were highest. We can come to that juncture another day. But that's something that we can – otherwise we'll be here all day talking about that.
Right. Part of the deficit during the Clinton – or the surplus during the Clinton administration was that people were paying more into Social Security than was going out because mm-hmm. the baby boomers hadn't moved to the age of retirement. And that's how Clinton managed to create a surplus by combining both a Social Security trust fund right. with the general operating funds of the – and now that's no longer the – President Obama and any president after this does not have that luxury.
If every president in Congress hadn't stolen from the trust fund, Social right. Security would be in fine shape today. 410-319-8888. Clarence, you're on the air.
Good afternoon, Mr. Steiner.
Hey, Clarence, welcome. Go ahead. Welcome.
Before you took your break, you basically said everything that I wanted to state. I'd just like to add something on to it.
Mm-hmm.
There's a phrase that I can't remember whether it's Latin or not, but it has to deal with being legal under the law but morally illegal. And I wholeheartedly basically believe in America that we have a system of laws that are legal under the law but immorally wrong, when you have one group of people who are allowed to take the pie and cut it into four pieces and take three quarters of it and leave the rest of the pie for the rest of us to cut up and get whatever we can get out of it. Corporate America is allowed to consolidate all of the wealth and power into its pocket, which, as was described to me one time, whereas in my country, lobbying would be considered bribery. The government must heal itself before it can do anything for the rest of the country. Thank you.
Thank you, Clarence. I appreciate the thought.
Well, I do think lobbying is out of control.
Way out of control.
Way out of control.
And we talk about that a lot in the show. Let me go to Jamar. Thank you so much for the thought, Clarence. 410-319-8888. Jamar, you're on the air. Jamar, are you there?
Can you hear me?
Yes, you're on the air.
Okay, thank
Welcome.
You very much. For
Welcome.
Stepping the hall. I have two questions
that
has perplexed me with the Republican Party. One is that I've heard the Republican Party, I was listening to when they were doing the elections to put in a new RNC. They said that the chief goal of the Republican Party was to make sure that Obama doesn't get back into office in 2012. All right, and my question is, with everything that's going on with this country in terms of the economy, jobs, the wars, how can they make that their chief goal? And also, in terms of health care, how is it that Obama, who basically agreed with the bill or disagreed with the bill, all of the basic premise of what he's trying to do is to provide health care for all Americans. And once again, it perplexes me why the Republicans would fight against having health care for all Americans. They repeatedly tried to defeat the bill and talk against the bill and so forth. But I would respect what they're doing a lot more if they said, well, Mr. President, here's how we can provide health care for all Americans better than what you're doing. And just gave a barrage of solutions to providing health care for all Americans rather than repealing the first step forward to providing health care for all Americans. They 100% supported us going into war, into Iraq. They 100% supported us going to Afghanistan. But then when it comes to health care, they don't want to do it. Can your guest explain that?
I think Brian Griffiths wants to have a shot at this first. Brian, you're on the
air. Well, the first part about the RNC chair's chief job being to defeat President Obama, that's kind of why political parties exist in this country, is to make sure our guys win and that other people don't win. We break off into shirts and skins. Whether it's good or bad, that's the way it is.
I'm pretty sure it was Dean's job to defeat George W. Bush.
Exactly. And that's perfectly fine.
Yeah. Except that he's not – I don't think he was talking about the chair of the RNC. He's talking about –
He's talking about Mitch McConnell.
Mitch McConnell in the U.S. Senate and senators and congressmen saying they're going to be an obstructionist to every bill that comes in. They're going to stop Obama from whatever he wants to do so they can defeat Obama.
But
not about what's good for the American people, but about defeating
Obama. But at the same time, is that not Senator McConnell's job as the Republican leader to stand up for what he believes is in the best interest of the American people? The Senator McConnell and the Republicans in the Senate, as well as Speaker Boehner and Leader Cantor and the Republicans in the House, do not believe that what the president wants to implement is good for the American people. It's why H.R. 2, the job crushing, as we renamed it, the Job Crushing Health Care Repeal Act, has passed. And that's because the Republicans in Congress believe that it is a bad law. They ideologically believe that it's not in the best interest of the American people to have this
but
be the law.
As you said, someone at this panel tell me, what are the Republicans offering in response to make sure that every American has health care?
Well, they now have a series of committees,
that are
looking at this issue, just as the Democrats had committees that looked at this issue, Mark. Don't put your head in your hand. This is just how they operate. This is how government works.
And it's very important that we have to understand that this
healthcare
bill, Obamacare, was more of an insurance reform act. It wasn't necessarily a healthcare reform act. And that's important because, like I was saying earlier, is that it's important that we clearly define what is health care.
I agree. And the other thing is, I think we should be more careful about who's against it, because the Tea Party and some of the Republicans are against it because it makes everybody have to buy health insurance. And they feel that that's not that's unconstitutional. The liberal parties, the Democrats, are unhappy because it didn't go far enough.
Right.
So there's this whole different reason why people are against it. I personally think that if we're going to mandate every hospital in the United States to provide service to people who walk through their emergency room doors, that there's no denial of service, then people have to pay for that right. So to make everybody buy health insurance is the correct thing, the moral thing to do.
Because otherwise we tie
people's hands behind their back.
I'm sorry.
The providers.
But with the buy health insurance, having health insurance in America, what does it mean? It means that I and my employees have to pay $2,500 before we can have any health care kick in. Because that's what most people have to do in America today. Unless you're a Hopkins employee or a city employee, and I'm not condemning you. I think I'm glad you two have the health care that you guys have because you deserve it. We all deserve it. But those of us in small businesses, those of us who are out there not working for a government or corporations that are cutting our health care every day anyway, are the health care we get in America sucks.
I hear what you're, you know, Mark, right. I hear what you're saying, and this is where I come back to Brian's point of view, which is we don't have a marketplace for health insurance. We have 50 little regulated monopolies, and you wouldn't have to pay $2,500 just before any insurance kicked in unless you chose to if we had true competition in the marketplace.
Or if we had a single-payer health plan where everybody kicked in like they do with Medicare and people had health care across the board and you'd have to worry about it.
But Mark, like we were, what I keep being a proponent of is that what is healthcare?
God love you,
though?
Mark.
I mean, it's
said God love you.
But Mark, what is healthcare now? I think we seriously have to define what healthcare is. The Swedish government defined it. The Japanese, where you have social welfare and the real social welfare that they have, the Swedish government defined it. Japanese government defined it. The French government defined it. Italian government defined it, where they actually have a very structured plan of action for its people to say, this is what the government provides for you. This is what you're entitled to as a citizen who works, which is very key, as a citizen who works.
If you can find a job.
In Sweden, the only way you can be part of their system, their welfare system, is if you work. If you're a working person, just like in Japan, the only place I know
you're absolutely wrong.
In Germany, you can just be a citizen and have entitled to certain health cares. But in Sweden, you actually have to be a working adult and be entitled to certain benefits.
No. That's not true.
There's certain benefits in Sweden. You have to be a working adult.
The problem with a single payer plan is that then the government tells me what I get to do, as opposed to
it doesn't have to be like that.
That's how it always is.
It's simply a pass-through system that pays for health care, not to say what you get and what you don't get. That's up to you and the doctor. That's up to the marketplace. And that's up to
without competition, now this is where I really am a Republican and an Adam Smith at heart. Without competition, costs will always skyrocket.
No,
they will always go up.
The competition is still there.
Where is
the
it?
The insurance
where?
To
where?
Pay for. The competition is in which doctor you go to and what
no,
doctor.
No,
but at that point, they're all basically government
no
employees.
What.
No, they're bureaucrats.
So right now, they're all employees of Blue Cross? What are you talking about?
Not all of them are employees of Blue Cross.
Excuse me. So they're employees of the insurance companies?
For the state of Maryland.
For the state of Maryland, they are.
No.
The different insurance companies for the state of Maryland, because I don't have a choice.
So the best way to do it is let it come out of our own pockets? You're contradicting yourself.
As far as healthcare is concerned, if you were going to healthcare in the state of Maryland, you reside in the state of Maryland, you can get healthcare that's for the state of Maryland. Maryland, Blue Cross, Kaiser,
whatever.
Let
me go back to the phones here, because I promised I would.
Okay.
Jim, I think you have the thing about healthcare across state lines. You're on the air.
Yes, good evening, Mark. How are you? To you and your guest.
Welcome.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi, Jim.
Hi. I forget which of the young men made a comment about, maybe the panacea is to buy the ability to buy insurance across state lines.
It was Ann McCarthy who started that.
Okay. If my recollection is correct, the health insurance industry is regulated by state agencies. If you are allowed to buy across state lines, what does that do to an insurance company's responsibility? Who's going to hold them responsible? If you can sell insurance from Maryland out to Indiana or wherever, and who's going to guarantee the quality of the policies, and who's going to look out for the customers, the patients?
See, now this is where I think the federal government.
The federal government has.
I mean,
What did you say, Jim?
He said, right now you have 50 state agencies doing the job for a population that crosses state lines in a more fluid way. I mean, I'm not saying that the federal government is a bad thing. I'm saying there's instances where it's appropriate that things should be handled at the federal level, instances where it's better at the state level, and instances where no government should be involved.
It's just like it's the same premise that goes with car insurance. Just like you can buy, you know, there's no such thing as Geico of Maryland. There's no such thing as a State Farm of New Jersey. You can buy State Farm, you know, across the board anywhere, and you can actually get as many quotes and as many insurance quotes as you possibly can that fix your personal needs and wants and also what the state requires you to have. That's what we're talking about here. We're talking about the same thing can be applicable, and the same thing can be easily applied to health insurance. Whereas if I'm a person and I have certain needs and wants that I want, and under the guidance of the state, and this is where government regulation comes from, they can say, well, when you purchase health care, you need to have these certain things in your health care plan. Well, then I can say, well, I don't like the health care plan of Blue Cross Blue Shield.
I
want to go to Indiana. I want to go to North Dakota. It's cheaper.
And Trey's point is a great point because, for example, as we talk about Geico and Progressive and all these national car insurance companies, they have to meet certain standards in order to sell policies in Maryland, in Virginia, and stuff like that, which is handled at the state level.
Those would be federal standards.
And that's fine.
No. But not in this. No. But like the Maryland Insurance Commission, for example, has certain standards for these companies to sell policies in Maryland. The agency already exists.
I would still posit that if you had a
single-payer
system that was simply a pass-through that covered all our health care with X amount of dollars being a copay. And then also you need to have regulations on hospitals about what they can purchase, what they can't purchase. See, we are out of time. I wish we didn't. It's good to have you all here. Folks, Gordon, Jim, Maria, hold on to next week. We'll have them back. No, we will. I like this. Anne McCarthy, thank you.
Thank you, Mark.
Brian Griffiths.
Always great to be here.
Trey Lewis.
Mark, always a good time.
It was a really good show. I enjoyed the conversation. And it's good. You see, you can have intensity and civility at the same time, can't you?
Yes, you can.
It is possible.
Let's look forward tonight.
Let's look forward everywhere. In our lives, in our country. Stay with us, folks. We'll be right back. We are going to be joined by Florence Martin, who just got back from Tunisia, and Aliza Geb, Palestinian, who goes back and forth all the time to talk about Tunisia and across the Middle East and what is going on with riots in Egypt, the rebellions in Tunisia, what's happening in Lebanon, and the revelations about Palestinians about to give away most of Jerusalem, but the Israelis said no. Talk about all that and more. Stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner, and the Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the University of Maryland Women's Health for every stage of a woman's life, offering compassionate care and comprehensive obstetric and gynecological services from routine exams to specialized pelvic surgery. For more information, you can go to 1-800-492-5538 or on the web at www.umm.edu/Women's Center, or go onto the Steiner Show website and click on the University of Maryland Medical Center banner, and all the information will be right there. We're going to talk about what's going on in the Middle East. It is all over the news. There are rebellions and riots all over Cairo today as we speak. The Tunisian army today came out in support, very, very public support in the last day of the rebellion inside of Tunisia that sent its president packing. What does it all mean for the Middle East? We saw revelations today that Palestinian leadership on the West Bank had offered almost all of Jerusalem to the Israelis and asked for 10,000 Palestinians a year for the next 5 years to come back to
Palestine. It takes 10 years.
It takes 10 years. And that was rejected, but that just came out in communiques that were released. There's a lot going on, but what is going on? We are joined by, once again, it's been a while, but she's back, Dr. Florence Martin, who is professor of French and Francophone literature and film at Goucher College. She's an expert on French North Africa and just came back from Tunisia. Dr. Ali Zagheb is a local businessman, but he was born in Palestine. He's very active in Palestinian and Palestinian-American affairs, goes back to his home on the West Bank in Palestine often, and he's a former professor at Birzeit University and Al-Najah University on the West Bank, and lives here in Maryland with his lovely family, and is a dear friend who I met on the show when he first came here in 1993 on these airwaves to debate Palestinian-Israeli issues. And Ali, a pleasure to see you again.
Nice to see you again. Thank you.
And you're welcome to join us at 410-319-8888. We have one email already who wrote to steinershow@gmail.com about Tunisia, and we'll read Basil's letter in just a moment. So let's start with Tunisia and work our way across. And I know Tunisia is your main area, so we can make back and forth to keep you.
And I'm delighted to be here and to finally talk about Tunisia. I really am.
So a little background. I remember I received this email from you, I think it was last week, when you were sitting frustrated and incensed somewhere listening to the Diane Rehm show because of the misinformation that was being given out on the airways. Tell us about that.
Well, I remember hearing, okay, so somebody set themselves on fire, and we all know the story now, although it's already couched with various myths, as in he was a college graduate, no, he wasn't, and so on and so forth. And all of a sudden, boom, there it comes. The whole Tunisian people follow. No. I mean, if I set myself on fire because I want, I don't know, equal wages for men and women, nobody is going to necessarily take the streets in droves. And yet I would have a point, right? So what happened there is it was really brewing. And when I was there in October, on the 15th of October, for instance, there were all these rumors that were circulating on Facebook, rumors that are started by the Tunisian people and rumors that are also spread by the government, by the way, because the government quickly caught on that this was a resistance tool. I had actually stopped being on Facebook because I don't like Facebook for multiple reasons and got back on to follow what was going on at that point. And the rumor was somebody had been kidnapped, a little child, north of Tunis, and then there was an incredible spread of police everywhere, barrages everywhere, roadblocks, much more than customary, which is often. And so, and then the counter rumors started on the streets. The army started to stage a coup and they failed. This was on October 15th.
These were all rumors.
These are all rumors.
Right.
The little kid that was supposed to be kidnapped and that would have warranted all this police activity, that turned out to be a completely planted rumor by the government to explain why there was so much police running around. The army thing was never, of course, as it was a rumor mill, because it's a society in which no press was given any free rein. So that was the only way to have any kind of, you know, circulation of news. Anyway, that was on October 15th. But that came at the end of 2.5 years since 2008, where the Gafsa the phosphate mines and industries in Gafsa started to kick out people because, you know, and increasing their unemployment there, which then, as it does in any little community, means that the local grocery shop has to close, the local cafe has to shop to close, and so on and so forth. And there were popular uprisings right then, which were brutally repressed. That was known in Tunisia. Al Jazeera reported it. Al Jazeera was the only one who reported it. Le Monde, one journalist in Le Monde,
which is the French newspaper.
Yes, thanks. Reported it and then was barred from Tunisia thereafter. And Le Monde once again went underground and was, you know, forbidden. In Tunisia. So when I heard the other day that this one guy started the revolution, no, it's been coming. It has been activated, perhaps. It was that little, it was really the last straw that completely broke the camel's back. But the camel had all these straws first that nobody is looking at, which was disturbing to me.
Do you think that what was going on in Tunisia is unique in the Arab world? I mean, let me posit this and see what you two think. I mean, that you've been to Tunisia?
I've been to Tunisia more than once, quite a few years back.
There's probably very few countries you haven't been to, but that clearly is one of them. But what I've heard is, and what I've been reading about, is that Tunisia itself is unique among Arab nations and North African nations, because the Tunisia, which right on the shores of the Mediterranean, that part of Tunisia, has been interacting with the globe and the world since the time of Carthage.
Since Dido, you know, and Aeneas.
It's one of the most ancient places on the earth.
Yeah. Carthage.
And Carthage sits now where Tunis and Carthage are very close in proximity, where Tunis is now is where Carthage once was. And that, so the, its cosmopolitan nature, its nature of interaction with Europe, has made that very different from other parts of the Arab world. And is that A, it fact, and B, does that have a factor in all of this?
It may be different on one hand, but on the other hand, if you look at it, if you look at the politics of it, which we are talking about right now, we have Arab leaders who come to the throne for whatever reason, via coup or someone dies, and they decide this is their inherent right. They're going to stay there till they are kicked out, like Zain Abidine Ali,
Ben Ali, the president of Tunisia,
or someone dies or gets killed. Unfortunately, Arab leaders, with the support of the Europeans and the American powers, you know, who are willing to wage wars and kill hundreds and thousands of Iraqi children to bring democracy to the Middle East, all of the Arab leaders, the dictators in the Middle East, are there with the support of the U.S. and the American powers. And Tunisia is really not different. Hosni Mubarak came after Sadat was killed in 82, 83. He is still there. King Abdullah of Jordan, who is really one of the most reasonable leaders in the Middle East, by the way, and he does work with the constitutional monarchy, also came after his father's death, and he's going to be there forever. And what applies to him, kings and emirs of the Gulf area, Algeria, you know, next door neighbor, Libya, he's been there since 69.
Yeah.
You know, Ali Saleh in Yemen, and there were major demonstrations in Yemen today, by the way.
Yemen today.
32 years he's been on the throne. You know, he calls himself a Republican democracy, but he's been there 32 years, and he's trying to groom his son to become the leader. And there were major demonstrations in Yemen, in Sana'a today, in the capital, and in Aden. So I do believe that this thing may catch and may catch well, and it's about time.
Well, Gaddafi is clearly afraid. I mean, the stuff he
Gaddafi,
says.
Gaddafi, the head of Libya.
Of Libya, right. Yes. He's clear, I mean, he even at some point was saying, you know, I'll arm the leftover people from Ben Ali. So that he was opening the borders right after Ben Ali left, so that his secret
Tunisia
police
is next to it.
And you have in Tunisia 35,000 people in the army versus 130,000 part of Ben Ali's militia. So of course it's not equal, right? So he was saying, "I'll arm you guys so you can put Ben Ali back in power," but the Tunisian people were very careful to monitor the border. I mean, it went that far.
And unlike other nations, not just Arab nations, but nations across the globe, Tunisia didn't invest a huge amount of money in its military. Its military is very much homegrown and smaller.
Yeah.
And it seems to be a bulwark standing behind the students against the police for the democracy movement at the moment. It seems that way.
Yes, they are the ones that absolutely refuse to shoot on the people from day one. Right, way before Ben Ali
left.
Yeah. By the way, it's interesting what you said about kings, because of course Ben Ali is was president of Tunisia, but they called him the reigning one. They called his regime the reign, and they called Leila, especially his wife, the queen. So.
Yeah, you know, technically they are. They call themselves Republicans and presidents and this and that. But if they have a son, like even in Syria, Bashar al-Assad inherited his father. This is a republic, you know, a socialist, democratic republic, 15 adjectives before you get to the name of the country. And all of these are Republican, democratic, socialistic governments, quote unquote, that should not, nobody should inherit the throne from the father. That is what happened in Syria. And I personally like what Bashar al-Assad is doing in Syria. I think he is trying to open Syria up much more so than his father did. And I do believe, I talk to a lot of Syrian people, they are not as unhappy with him as they were with his father. The same thing applies. Even go to Palestine, the Palestinian territory. We have a president whose term, quote-unquote, ran out. And really, the presidential elections in Palestine, monitored by many international groups, were the most authentic elections in the history of the Middle East. And Mahmoud Abbas, after the death of Arafat, ran a very clean campaign. But his term had expired, okay, and he is still there. He is not willing to have elections, whether he's pressured by the U.S. or not to have elections or not. They're all afraid that Hamas may win again. But his term had expired, the legislature's term had expired, and he is still hanging to power, feeding the public something, and feeding the Israeli, as the leaks that appeared on Al Jazeera mm-hmm. indicate to all of us.
What do you think that this Tunisian rebellion portends for Tunisia and for the rest of the Arab world? I mean, you were saying today, I saw what happened in Egypt. I was watching today what was going on in Egypt and the riots in Cairo, and you were saying in Sana'a in Yemen
yeah.
they're taking place as well. And you've got Gaddafi, who is this caricature of a leader who's kind of, but he's got power because he's yeah. got money and he's got arms. And what do you think this portends for the next year throughout the Middle East? What do you think will happen? Well, what do you see happening?
Let's go back to Tunisia one second. I see Tunisia right now is in the throes of its own movements and contradictions and tensions. And so it is, you know, as you know, it is not agreeing on the present temporary government that is supposed to take over until the elections are as predicted, as you know, is warranted by the constitution, happens 60 days after there is a vacation in power. So they are going to have to, it's not to learn, because one of the things that is, what is very important about Tunisia is it is an inordinately very, very, very educated population. I mean, the north is amazing. It's full of people who have 5 years into college and, you know, graduate school and so on and so forth. And they right now have to kind of put together a reconciliation government or an opposition that is not, it's there, but it's in shambles. It's been squashed for 23 years. People were tortured
in the
prison. Yeah. More, because Bourguiba's reign also.
Bourguiba being the founding president of modern Tunisia.
Yeah, correct.
Who in the beginning was wonderful and then...
Oh, yeah. You know, Bourguiba, and I could say a lot of negative things about him, but you mentioned education in Tunisia.
Yes.
And really, all of that is due to Bourguiba. And I remember, I think, one of his sayings, he said, I'd rather, when people asked him, you know, why do you want to educate everybody? Wouldn't that be dangerous to your regime? And if I recall, I don't recall the exact saying, but he said, I'd rather deal with uneducated people than uneducated, no matter what. And that is to his credit. He really did do a lot of...
And for women.
For men and women, yes. You're absolutely correct. The same thing with Jordan and Palestine, King Hussein of Jordan. He was very instrumental in bringing an educational system where a lot of the Jordanians and Palestinians are much more educated, regardless of their limited resources, than the rest of the Arab world.
But what you could say,
couldn't
you say the same thing about Saddam Hussein in Iraq? I mean,
the women, yes.
Women in Iraq, and the educated. The education level of Iraqis, especially in the large cities, was overwhelming, and many of those people are here now or have fled to other places or in Syria. or in Turkey because
or Jordan, yeah,
or Jordan,
yeah.
But I mean that is the case in many metropolitan areas.
Well, absolutely. You know, believe me, I was, as you know, against the war in Iraq. I still am, not because I loved Saddam, but I do believe that even Iraq during Saddam's regime was much better off. All Iraqis were much better. Let's say not all, but 90% of Iraqis were much better off than now, you know, after all the deaths and the killings and the dismembering of the country that we're going through now. So some of these dictators do have some positive things, but not many.
So now in Tunisia, the left is not organized, let's say, to take a sort of shortcut.
Is it organized anywhere in the Arab world?
No, I really do believe that.
Let's see.
The left is, I think, dead throughout the whole Middle East. I really don't think that. And I think most people are not interested in the left. I think what they are interested in is basically a caring regime that has 4 or 5 years, or in the case of Lebanon, 7 years for the president. And after that, let's find another face, a new regime, a new administration that hopefully will be in touch with the reality of the thing. Like Hosni Mubarak, roughly 30 years. And if you ask any Egyptian, other than a very few who are associated with him, they are in much worse shape now than 30 years ago. And that is what the Arab world is yearning for, change of faces, a new regimes that are in touch with reality.
But what are we seeing? What could happen on the ground, on the other side here? I mean, it seems to me that there's always, whether it's Egypt or Yemen or even Tunisia perhaps, that because there is no real democratic opposition, because there's no lefts, that what can fuel any revolution or any move to throw people out is something that's much more Islamic in nature, that's much more fundamentalist in nature, that despite all the miserable dictatorships, could wipe out the gains of women, could do many other things. I mean, what about that role in all this, whether you're talking about Hamas or anything else?
Or the Muslim Brothers in Egypt. And I think when you leave the population, and in this case, not just in Egypt and the West Bank, in Palestine or Jordan, most of the opposition comes from the Muslim Brotherhoods and the Islamists. I hate the word Islamist, so I'm not going to use it, but the Islamic factions. And unfortunately, most of these factions want to take us back, 300 and 400 years back, especially when it comes to the rights of women.
Yes.
Yeah. And that
but you're a Muslim, right?
I am a Muslim. Yeah, of course I'm a Muslim.
And
yeah.
you
haven't converted.
You haven't converted. You keep to many. you keep to some of the.
Absolutely, Islam is a beautiful religion. Yeah. It's been hijacked by a bunch of idiotic creatures who want to live in the 13th and 14th century. Even during the Prophet Muhammad's years, Muslims were not nearly as fanatical about Islam and about covering women the way they are now. I think you met my mother, if I recall.
Yes, I did meet your mother when she was here.
She was an 85-year-old beautiful woman. She shook hands with men. She hugged men.
Right.
She hugged you like she hugged me.
Right. Well, we broke Ramadan together. We broke fast together.
Islam is not under any circumstances a religion where we should segregate the sexes and keep women in the tent, you know. That is not Islam. And unfortunately, since you don't have the educated opposition to these regimes, people are going to look for anything to go to. And I'm afraid that the hardcore religious right in Palestine, like it's in Israel,
among Jews in Israel, it's the same thing. Right.
These are the ones who are fanatics and who may, unfortunately, control the dice.
I think that's why it's important to follow Tunisia, because I might be an optimist on this one, but even though there is a structured movement there, that has been also completely arrested, tortured, and so on and so forth. I don't think it is such a tiny minority. Tunisia is a very secular state.
Well, and that's again because of Bourguiba, if you remember.
Right.
Bourguiba once
drinking orange juice.
He had his faults, absolutely.
Okay, yes.
But on the other hand, when it comes to religion and when it comes to women and their rights, he was an avant-garde in the far front of really even more so than most European countries in those days.
And what Florence what you were alluding to was when Bourguiba, who was the first president of an independent Tunisia when it became an independent nation that France ran that part of North Africa, had this TV program during Ramadan, the holiest time of the Islamic calendar, when he drank orange juice to say because he wanted to break the fast and say we have to be modernists, we can't be back in it.
You say we can't afford to not do anything for a month. Oh, that was, you know, clearly an exaggeration. We can't afford this because we're a third world country and we need to work.
Folks, let me open the phones here. Pardon me. 410-319-8888 is the number here. Join us. We're talking about the Middle East. We're talking about Tunisia and the rest of the Middle East. What's going on? Because the future of the Middle East is our future as well. It's the world's future. And we're going to talk about what may be happening with the rebellion in Tunisia, how it's bleeding into Egypt, how it's bleeding into Yemen, how it may be affecting the West Bank and Palestine, how it could affect what's going on in Lebanon, which we'll talk about a little bit as well. Number is 410-319-8888. And we are joined by Dr. Florence Martin, who is professor of French and Francophone literature and film at Galta College and expert on Tunisia, who just came back from Tunisia. Dr. Ali Zaghab, who is a businessman here in the United States, but he was born in Palestine. He was an activist in Palestine, a professor at Birzeit University and Al-Najah University in the West Bank, and was a leader of a nonviolent resistance movement among students and professors at the university when he was shown the Allenby Bridge and told to get out of the West Bank by the Israelis, blindfolded and sent across the river. But has been back since and now makes his home between Maryland and Palestine, where he maintains his home in the village that he was born in. 410-319-8888 is the number here to have a conversation with our guests about the Middle East. There's an email we received from Basil, who writes in, "Good evening, Mark. Thanks for covering the happenings in Tunisia, truly sending shockwaves through many capitals, not just in the Arab world. Funny, but you have to search high and low to find any coverage on RMSM. I guess let's not give the saps here any ideas. Only folks at the BBC are covering it. I bet if some Islamists, e.g. Iran, have taken over the country, our media would be all over this one. This is a populist and secular revolt versus a top-down revolution, enough to scare capital all elites because they can't control it. I mean, what do you do when the army and now the security forces are on the side of the people? Scary, ain't it? As the great Bugs Bunny would say. right now, on to our brothers in Tunisia. Stay in the streets until you have a true democracy. Your thoughts, Flo.
Indeed, stay on the streets. Actually, my friends in Tunisia, as of last night, were telling me via email and Facebook, we are tired of this. We'd like to go back to work, please, and start building our country, which is finally our country. And it's both, you know, a stage of wonderment and great joy and a stage of slight fear. I think that, yes, we do need to, by the way, support the Tunisian people and, for instance, have the Americans, you know, the business sector still invest in Tunisia.
Absolutely.
And tourism go on and so on and so forth, because they will need that.
Tunisia has some of the best beaches on the Mediterranean.
Yes.
And
what are we doing here?
Yeah. No,
and
but
the best food.
I do believe that there should be investments that, you know, the World Bank, the IMF, and people of that nature who have money and who have access to money, they should try to invest in countries of that nature to move these countries forward instead of, you know, having these countries fall in the hands of the radicals who are sometimes who do more harm than good. I'm sorry, Flo.
But not through the IMF and all these people had done that, through the Ben Ali and Trabelsi families, and that was a total disaster. That we don't want repeated.
But once we have a government by the people, for the people, I do believe that such governments will invest in the people, and they will not have 500 kilograms of solid gold bars that they will take with them to Dubai when they leave the country.
I agree.
Yeah. Let's, people are calling in. Let's get to the phones. Yes. I don't know if there's a relation to you or not, since this man has the same last name as you. 410-319-8888 from California, Fred Martin.
Yes, my brother.
Fred, you're on the air.
Hi, I have a question about the possibility of truth and reconciliation process as in South Africa after the rampant deletion that had been going on for the past 20 years or so, where the police and everybody was part of the police and everybody was telling on everyone. So I'd like to know if you can discuss this a little bit.
Super question, Fredo. yes, that is one. Actually, that is one of my anxieties. What happens next? Because when I was in Tunisia 5 years ago, I spent a few months there. People would say, half of the people here are cops, and the other half are normal people. This is the Tunisian phrase, normal people. And this time in October, it was 2/3 are cops, and 1/3 is. And you could see the tension was mounting. And so, what do you do? Because the cops right now, or the militias, suddenly have shifted. I mean, do you say, well, that's the nature of a police force that just will go with the power in, and I hope I'm not insulting anybody here, but in Tunisia, so they see that the wind is turning, and so they go there. But what am I going to do when I see this cop who tortured my brother for 2 years? Am I going to let them off the hook or what? And the truth and reconciliations worked in some fashion in South Africa. In Rwanda, let's not even think about it. And in Morocco, when I asked, well, what happened after Hassan II left?
King Hassan.
Yeah, King Hassan. Died. And then there is, died rather. Yeah, well, he really left.
He didn't leave, yeah.
And then Mohammed VI went on. They did not punish the former torturers. And they did not have a reconciliation and forgiveness thing either. And actually, one Moroccan friend of mine, who's an academic in Tetouan, told me, well, Flo, this is a very Christian idea or Judeo-Christian idea. It is not a Muslim one.
And absolutely not true, by the way.
That's what I thought.
No. Islam, in fact, I could, quote something. Muawiyah, one of the best caliphs in the world, said, do you need justice or what is better than justice to someone who came to complain to him?
Right.
And the guy said, is there anything better than justice? He said, forgiveness,
yes,
and mercy. So it's a very Islamic. The Quran, you cannot even recite any verse from the Quran without saying, in the name of Allah, the merciful, the compassionate. So
right.
Mercy, the Prophet talked about mercy. It's a very, very Islamic idea. I think the question is, do we have anybody like Desmond Tutu and
Mandela,
in the Middle East? With all due humility, I don't think that we do. Maybe they are coming in the future, I cannot tell you. But I really do believe if a new government takes place in Tunis, and this government is by the people for the people, I do believe that people will be more than willing to forgive and forgive and move forward. But they're not going to move forward if their economic situation does not improve.
Yes, I completely agree.
And hence, the importance or the crux of the matter is most of these people really were out on the streets. Like, we don't see people in Libya out on the streets. I don't think that we'll ever see them because they are being given money and sustenance and whatever it is by Gaddafi, who has billions of dollars to give to the people, no matter how much he could hoard. In Jordan and Egypt, like in Egypt, more than 50% of the 80 million people live on $2 a day or less. Okay, the same in Yemen, and these are United Nations statistics. The same in Yemen, more than 50% of the population lives on less than $2. And the same in Jordan, it's not as bad in Jordan, but there were demonstrations in Jordan. Again, King Abdullah was able to defuse the situation, at least for the time being. And with all due respect to other Arab leaders, King Abdullah really does work within a constrained constitutional,
framework
or kingdom or whatever it is
We need to take a very short break and come right back. Madison, don't hang up. Your next caller up. You want to hear what your question is about women. I think it's about women. But if it's not, you can still ask the question, whatever it is. We'll come right back with Dr. Ali Zagheb and Dr. Florence Martin. 410-319-8888 is the number here. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner, and the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by Urbanite Magazine's new e-zines. It's a simple way to stay connected to the topics and events you care about most. Daily content on arts, culture, food, design, style, green living, and much more can be delivered to your inbox. Registration is available at UrbaniteBaltimore.com. Again, you can go to the Steiner Show website and click on the Urbanite banner and get all the information there as well. We are joined in the studio by Dr. Florence Martin. Is that right?
Yes.
Yes. So is Professor of French and Francophone Literature and Film at Goucher College. Dr. Ali Zagheb, who is a businessman, who was born in Palestine, active in both Palestinian-American affairs. Palestinian-American affairs, was a professor at Birzeit University and Al-Najjar University on the West Bank before he was thrown out of the West Bank by Israeli forces many, many years ago.
33, to be exact.
33 years ago. Shown the Allenby Bridge and said, leave. He was a leader of a nonviolent movement in among students and professors at the universities. He goes back and forth, though, now all the time between Palestine and the United States of America, maintains a home on the West Bank in Palestine as well as here in Maryland. Number is 410-319-8888. And Madison, you're on the air.
Good evening.
Good evening. Madison, how are you?
I'm doing good.
Hi.
Nice to hear your voice. You're blowing my cover.
Not with me. I still don't know who you are, but go ahead.
I wanted to back at the opinion, actually, which expressed by you that Islam is not only one of the most beautiful, but one of the great religions of the world. And I think that their fundamentalists are not any scarier than Christian fundamentalists.
Or Jewish or anybody else.
There we go.
KKK.
I wish we could say that a little more often. I wanted to ask Dr. Florence Martin, who's experienced both of these things, on average, which religion has treated women better? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Thank you, Madison.
That's an interesting one. Madison, I don't think I'm ducking out of this one. I respect you too much for this. However, I think all Orthodox religions, unfortunately, when pushed to the extreme, treat women like dirt. So that being said, a Muslim Sufi woman that I know in Morocco is the most amazing person I know, one of the most amazing persons I know. And she's obviously not being treated as, you know, dirt by her religion. But that said, they said she also clearly fights for her rights and talks to other Muslim women who, you know, there's, first of all, we talk about Islam, there are so many branches like Christianity, for instance. Right. So it's kind of difficult.
No, it's not as complicated, really. There's the Sunni and the Shiites, and you know the Sufis. The Sufis are really not even a branch. They are a different
group. They're on their little corner.
A different group of Muslims. I have a lot of respect for them myself because they believe in peace and love and all that. Very nice, educated, cultured group of people. Yeah.
And if you know, one of the things we don't even think about when it comes to the entire Muslim world, we know so little in this country.
Unfortunately, yes. I'm sorry, it looks like everybody knew you except me, Mr.
It's Madison Smart
Bell.
I think, as Flo said, unfortunately, religions that were here about 2,000 plus or 5,000, 2,000, 1,700 years ago, reflected their times more so than they claim sometimes they reflected all the times, but I think they reflected their times, and their times were extremely difficult for women. And some of that difficulty stayed with the religions. So whenever you deal with any kind of Orthodox Muslim, Orthodox Christian, Orthodox Jews, I do believe that they do not regard women in a beautiful manner. However, you have that other segment of the population, whether they're Christians or Muslims or Jews, who moved forward with their lives and with their thoughts and ideas about religion. And I do believe that women now, in general, are in much better shape than they were even 50 years ago.
How on one level, destabilizing a factor will these rebellions be and become to these old Arab regimes? How much are we not expecting? Are we seeing something that is akin to what happened in Eastern Europe? Are we seeing something?
In 88, you mean?
Yeah. Are we making too much of this? This is just Tunisia, and now we're seeing anger spill out in Egypt and Yemen and maybe in other places, but that you really, it's just isolated, and this will be happen in Tunisia and then
I think it is a model in some specific ways. The use of social networks is one. I mean, that's all over. The Egyptians are doing the same thing. I mean, all of a sudden, I said, oh, yeah, we can do this. This had started in Iran, of course. And also, what fascinates me, and it's not because I'm a professor of French and Francophone studies, it's me, but to see today this picture in Le Monde, of course,
The French newspaper. Yeah.
Thank you, Ali. of a demonstration in Egypt with the sign "Dégage Mubarak, Dégage," which is "Go away, get off, get off my space." Literally, is what it means.
Which was used in Tunisia,
used in Algeria. If you see of all these pictures and all everything that goes going through Facebook, you see that same "dégage," which is also part of rap language and so on and so forth. So there is some of that. Uh-huh. It's invoked at least the Tunisian revolution, which is not led by a party but is led by the people.
And how much of these revolutions are also the young? And what you just said about Degage and in music. What I've noticed about these, this is another factor, and for all of us who are a little older than this generation, but that it is there is a African-American culture around the world and the hip-hop culture around the world is part of the new Arab rebellion, whether it's on the West Bank, whether it's in Gaza, whether it is in Egypt, Yemen, Tunisia. I mean, you're seeing the hip-hop culture reinterpreted in this kind of Arab Euro-pop, hip-hop culture that is kind of fueling this in many ways, which is something that we also don't pay much regard to, but it's also a globalization of international youth protest culture.
I think the globalization really, not even in the hip-hop, to be honest, because hip-hop is still not very well known in Egypt and in the rest of the Arab world. You may find some groups that do that or listen to it.
Isn't there an underground hip-hop movie? Because I've seen films about this that are amazing.
What is really infusing, thousands.
Infusing the blood in this is really Facebook and Twitter. Like in Egypt today, Twitter was completely blocked. The government blocked the whole thing today after the demonstration. And this thing in Tunisia will be extremely important depending on what happens in Egypt. Egypt is still the citadel in the Arab world. And like Peoria, as we say here, whatever happens in Peoria happens in the rest of the country. And if Egypt, if the young people, and it is the young people who are not or who are willing to sacrifice. Samuel Johnson, the 18th century, said, "He who hath wife and child is subject to fortune." So you have to be careful to feed a family if you have a wife and child. The young people don't have families to feed. They don't have jobs to even worry about. They are the ones who are going to move forward with the country. And if they move forward in Egypt, I think the rest of the Arab world will see great days in the future. Unless such things are hijacked, like when Bourguiba right. became senile at the end, Zain al-Abidin bin Ali,
right.
myself, I thought, fresh face, fresh blood, and things should improve. But when you sit on that chair for 30-plus years, so if these movements do not give us democracies that have a span of 4 to 7 years where people can get you out of that chair without having demonstrations and without having, you know, killing and fighting and people being killed and police officers fighting, if we do not have democracy in the full sense of the term, all this, unfortunately, will be just down the drain.
Flo, mm-hmm. you want to add to that?
Egypt? How about Algeria? No, it doesn't count.
Algeria does not really count. It is not. Egypt has 80 million people.
True.
Yeah. Egypt, the Egyptian soap operas, for example, the Egyptian movies, the Egyptian music, that is really what permeates the whole Middle East, Arab, Islamic world, more so than any country in the Arab world. Egypt has a great civilization, a great culture, and it had some magnificent writers, people who are well-respected, journalists. Nobody in the Arab world, you know, compares to whether it's Jamal Abdel Nasser or the famous journalist Mohammed Hassanein Haykel or Najib Mahfouz, the writer who won the Nobel Prize. Egypt really does carry a lot of weight in the Arab world.
Let's be up on the phone so the folks are joining us here, 410-319-8888. We are going to do another show just about the Arab hip-hop world. I think that it's, I mean, I
may be underestimating. I'll stand corrected.
I just pulled up the site just because I wanted to look at it while I was talking about it. And we had this conversation the other week, and I've been in an email conversation. I've not talked to him in a while because I didn't want to jeopardize his safety. I don't even know if this is his real name or not. But when the Gazan Youth Movement broke out, did you read mm-hmm. about this?
Yeah.
Where they came out with this manifesto?
No.
Yeah, these Gazan Youth came out with a manifesto. And I can't use the words on the air because we right. kicked off the air, but the word is an F word. Mm-hmm. And the manifesto started with F Hamas, F Israel, F Fatah.
The Palestinian Authority.
Yeah. F United States of America, the United Nations. We want freedom. We want democracy. We want to live our lives. And so I'm on their website now, like Gaza Youth Breaks Out is what it's called. And I was talking back and forth with this young man named Mohammed, but then I've been talking to him through a Spanish reporter who works for El País and the London Observer, the Guardian, and they're there. You know, I mean, there's a movement, and I'm very curious about how broad this movement of young people really is throughout the Arab world. That is this kind of fueled by democracy and freedom, not by Islamic fundamentalism, not by anything else, not by left or right, but by something. Something much more basic in youth. I just really discover how widespread this is. I don't know the answer to that.
That message is the one. The Tunisians could have said that they wouldn't use the F word because they're very polite. But it is there, this hip hop movement, and I'm thinking in Morocco there is one festival. It's as if this is one, this little margin of, okay, for 8 days or 3 days, I think it's 3 days, you can do whatever you want. And it's El Boulevard, it's called, and it's in Casa, and it's called Casa Neira also. And there was a documentary made on this by my Sufi woman friend. And it's fascinating. All of a sudden, this is not, you don't recognize the streets. It's full of young people.
There's something going on.
Yes.
And as Bob Dylan said, you don't know what it is, do you, Mr. Jones? You know?
No, absolutely there's something going on. But as I said, and I'm going to repeat this more than once, mm-hmm. Egypt is the
pinnacle.
It is the keystone.
Because it's still the...
And if this movement succeeds, and I do hope, and I don't do that much praying, but I'm going to pray now, and I pray it succeeds... Things will be much better in the whole Middle East. They would be much better. People deserve democracy. People deserve freedom. People deserve human rights.
And
people,
on their own terms.
And people deserve to rule and be ruled on their own terms.
Yes.
That is what made this country great.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, it has resources, but we don't lack resources in the Middle East.
Right, and
if these resources are done the right way.
And that is what that's one of the reasons the world still looks, not to America, but to the American spirit as the beacon of freedom.
And it's a great spirit. Believe me, that is the best thing that this country brought to the world, absolutely, by far.
410-319-8888. Gordon in Columbia, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi.
Hi, Gordon.
Good evening, Mark.
Good evening.
And good evening to your guests.
Thank you, sir. Good evening.
Hello.
Yes. Truly, I appreciate the overview you guys have given with regards to what's going on in Tunisia. One of the guests basically said, hey, there was quite a background leading up to this thing. And a couple of people have called it the WikiLeaks revolution. So do I need to be corrected on that also?
I think the WikiLeaks did not trigger it either, but it is one element of it. I really think so. What do you think?
Oh, I really do believe that it contributed. The WikiLeaks effect, we still haven't felt its total effect on, just not in this country, all over the world. And I do believe that it is contributing to everything that happens, whether it's the Middle East or in Europe. Its significance on the events in the Middle East could not be underestimated. People talk about it. I talk to people in the Middle East every single day. They are talking about the WikiLeaks. They are talking about Al Jazeera, which the Al Jazeera just published, and that is in the WikiLeaks spirit. I do believe, except for the WikiLeaks, these things that Al Jazeera published about the Palestinian Authority would not have been published as quickly or as easily. So the WikiLeaks is a great thing, and I think it's to the benefit of the human race.
If you look in strange places, not your usual sites, and as we're talking, I'm looking at Gaza Youth Breaks Out, their Facebook page, which I'm on frequently. Someone wrote in, I don't know where he's from, but a WikiLeaks just released, and Al Jazeera put it up, revealed that British and American and Israeli complicity in locking up counterinsurgency against Hamas and others. And they said we should explore the temporary internment of leading Hamas and, I can't read, but there's other things, Palestinian figures, make sure they're well treated with EU funding to kind of put people away. So, I mean, what WikiLeaks is doing is throwing these things open that nobody knew about.
Absolutely.
That I think that does in some ways fuel the consciousness of many young people around the Arab world who can feed into it because of this new social media that didn't exist before.
Absolutely. And this social media, let me go back to even Hamas. When the Palestinians elected Hamas in 2004, again, Hamas became one more seat than Fatah. Most Palestinians are not that religious, to be honest with you. We are not fanatics by nature, but they were so fed up with Fatah because Fatah was reigning since 65, basically. And they had a lot of respect for Arafat, but Arafat was gone. People were able to express themselves and basically vote against Fatah.
Well, you said yourself on my show many years ago when the election took place, the last election between Hamas and Fatah, You said yourself, I would vote for Hamas because I'm sick of these people.
Absolutely, I would have
voted for
and I'm one of the least religious people in town. I would have voted for Hamas because I just wanted to change faces. I wanted to have a new face. And unfortunately, Hamas, they didn't know how to play their cards.
I wish we had more time. Thank you, Gordon, for your call. Dr. Florence Martin, thank you so much for joining. It's been a pleasure to have you in the studio once again.
Thank you. It was
good to have you with us.
Thank you so much.
My dear friend, Dr. Ali Zagib, good to have you here.
Thank you, sir. Nice to see you.
Good to see you. Now we're ready for dinner, right?
I'm ready.
Okay. Let's
Bon appétit.
No.
The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. For more information, you can go to www.mecu.com or link onto their banner on the Steiner Show website. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Justin Levy and Christina Arison. We're engineered by Brian Boone. Our intern today is Daniel Gillespie. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. To hear this show again, podcast any of our past shows, hear new additional interviews that are on the web. We don't want to miss them. And find out more information about our guests, information we talked about, go to steinershow.org. And for public radio, it'll be EAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care. The Mark Steiner Show.